Welcome to Moving the Needle in Medicine. I'm your host, Alexander Heidichuk. On today's episode, I'm joined by Dr. Phil Adamson, a physician, innovator, and leader whose work has helped shape the future of cardiovascular care and medical technology. We'll discuss the intersection of medicine, innovation, and leadership, and what it takes to move healthcare forward. Let's get into it. Alrighty, everybody. Welcome to Moving the Needle in Medicine. I'm very delighted to be joined today in our next episode with Dr. Phil Adamson, who is currently the CMO of CVRx, who makes the Barostim device and has been a very influential figure in the field of heart failure as it's transformed over the last several years. I'm super excited to have you here. I'm filming here from Tulsa, Oklahoma. I know that you have some ties to Oklahoma. Looking forward to hearing about that. But I just want to open with, just hearing about your story. Kind of how you got to this point from the 1,000-foot view.
Well, thanks for having me, Alex. And it's really nice to be in this conversation because you really don't spend a lot of time reflecting, honestly, and we all probably ought to do more of that to create gratitude and the things that we can look back on and be happy about from a retrospective view. And it's interesting. I started in medicine after having a career in accounting of all things, and was an oil and gas tax accountant, believe it or not. And that's how I put myself through college, as well as through medical school. And it took me actually three times to apply to medical school to get accepted because they thought I was distractible. I didn't know what I wanted to do. And, I'd had all these careers I'm a third application when I was put on the deferred list and then finally was accepted at the University of Oklahoma. I was, it was a really obviously momentous time, but it kind of set my face to prove to those people who thought that I either couldn't do it or wouldn't do it, to really focus and put all my efforts into becoming a physician, but also really being someone who could understand the underlying pathophysiology rather than what I perceived as more of a technician to deploy remedies for diseases. And, early on in my pre-med work, my undergraduate degree after my accounting degree was physiology, and I just fell in love with the story. I'm a storyteller, and the story of physiology was just absolutely fascinating, how everything works together. And, that just was all, I felt like I could spend the rest of my life looking at that. And lo and behold, I have. And so it is amazing how we expect young people to make a decision about the rest of their lives without a whole lot of experience in the things that they like or they want to do. And so I think there's a lot of people stuck in areas that they really don't like because they didn't know. And once they got there, they had to either stay locked into what they said they were going to do or make a change. And it turns out in my career and my journey, just about every 10 years, I didn't plan this, but about every 10 years, there's been a major sort of change in my focus or in my environment. And I think that's been very healthy for me, at least, to sort of look for those opportunities and make it clear that, things can change and change for the good. Mm-hmm.
So was there a specific thing in physiology? Did you have like a light bulb or an aha moment?
I fell in love with the cardiovascular system early on. And early on, like in the undergraduate studies, I was fascinated by renal physiology, but cardiovascular physiology, when you think about something like exercise physiology, how does this system, how does the brain tell the body, I'm getting ready to exercise, I'm anticipating exercise, and then experience it and then have all those sensors flood the central nervous system with input that can be processed instantaneously and support the blood supply and support the heart and support you. And I think, you know, it became clear to me that the brain was correct. It was right. The cardiovascular system was the most important piece of survival for a human being. And how that all works together was a big fascination to me. So I knew when I was in undergraduate that eventually, at the end of the day, I was going to do my very best to specialize in cardiology. I mean, I had a few distractions here and there, but it was the cardiovascular system was just fantastic. And when I really got started into my efforts in science, I recognized that, you know, the whole functioning and the survival of a human being relies on how the brain alters things instantaneously to survive. And started looking into sort of the neurocardiology side of things that could be good, could be bad, actually. And that was a real important time for me because I had a family member die suddenly at age of 45 after a myocardial infarction. And this was in, heck, it was probably in the late 70s. Or early, mid, late 70s, early, but yes. So, I mean, many moons ago. And there wasn't a whole lot one could even do for myocardial infarction at the time. And in the ambulatory sort of rehabilitative phase of myocardial infarction, this family member died suddenly in front of the family. And it was just a tragic process. And I recognize how impactful a sudden death really is. And so my focus, you know, much of which has happened in my life is sort of, you know, providence or serendipity. But when I had the opportunity to really be involved in trying to understand the underlying mechanisms of sudden cardiac death, it was a real defining moment for me. And that's those opportunities kind of fell in place as I went through medical school. So it was, you know, you wind up finding a niche, but it's important, I think, that you look for the opportunities that niche leads to.
Mm-hmm. And so where did you grow up? And then you mentioned Oklahoma for med school, but where'd you grow up and then undergrad and progress?
Yeah. So I went, so I grew up in a small town in kind of central western Oklahoma, just west of Oklahoma City, a town named El Reno. And that was important because, you know, it turns out my sort of that switch, you know, that you have when you're young, got flipped when I was a sophomore, I think, in high school, and I was allowed to take a physics course. And the teacher was Mr. Marquette. He wound up at some point in time in the future become a patient of mine. He passed away from a cancer, I think. He was early in his teaching career. I think he'd been teaching for a couple of years, and he really made physics fun. He made it, you know, that whole, you know, discovery thing and illustrated to me how just gratifying discovery could be. And I had a lot of things that happened between that time and when I went to medical school, but it just instilled something that, you know, that made me drive. It drove me to a career as a physician scientist. And I attribute much of the spark to that experience. It's really amazing when you think about all the things that do influence you, that one thing you can point to, if you can, is many times what others would find to be very trivial or you know, not important, but it just made me a real interested person, I guess, in finding new things out. I couldn't wait to understand why things happened.
Yep. That's interesting you say about, you know, in high school. I mean, I feel very similarly. I remember taking biology and then AP biology with the same high school teacher, Mr. Brzee. And he just made it fun. And the physiology section, you could just tell that he was so passionate about it. And I think that I think he told the story of like how he wanted to go to med school, but it was going to be such a long road. So he liked teaching and he went that road instead. And he also played hockey. And so we kind of had that in common. And so we just really got along. And he was one of the early inspirations for me. And it kind of did give that spark. And you know, you're staying late and you're learning extra and you're not just studying for the test, just you're learning it because you're just fascinated in it.
Yeah, absolutely. That was, I think that piece, what you just mentioned, was really instrumental in my development, which was, you know, I switched at that early age. I kind of began to evolve into understanding what it is, what education was about. You know, I wasn't, I switched from memorizing stuff to regurgitated on a test to, you know, I'm trying to understand this broad scope of knowledge. Whether it be literature or poetry or science, you know, you know, understanding it is much different than just simply successfully, you know, taking a test.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that is one of the things as you progress throughout learning and education and you know this lifelong learning path. You know, early on, you know, to say high school, you're learning things in the textbook and you're like, oh, this is just what it is. And then you start to learn more and you figure out, you learn up to where we actually know and where we think we know and what's actually being studied. And then you're like, I could actually make a difference here. And a significant difference. And you just kind of you figure out what you like the most and what you're thinking about in the shower or on nights and weekends. It doesn't feel like you're truly working. You're so passionate about something and you just kind of dive right in.
You know, Alex, it's funny because you're right. And the funny piece is that there was a point in my development, and I think it was probably in the early 80s. And I was in medical school and had done some research and you know, when thinking about, do I want to take an academic approach towards medicine? Do I want to be a physician scientist? You know, I stepped back and said, we know everything. There's no answer that hasn't been, or no question hadn't been answered. And I look back on that and I laugh because today I'm at the point where, you know, 40 years later, 45 years later, I'm at the point, do I even know anything? You know, every layer of the onion I peel back, there's a whole new civilization that has to be
Right.
investigated. And every piece of knowledge that we have can be challenged, and the underlying mechanisms of that sort of you know, truth can be challenged to revise how we think about things. And it was hilarious. Now that I look back, at the time it was a really hard decision because, you know, obviously it's a tough decision to choose to be an academic physician, as it, you know, compared to, you know, a private practitioner. But, you know, for me, it turned out to be a real positive thing. And in fact, it was several mentors that I had that guided me into that process. But it was a big decision at the first because I sure thought that I couldn't contribute because everybody knew everything.
So in medical school, at that point, you kind of knew that you were going to go head down the cardiology path.
I did, yeah, and you know, my research career started actually when I was an undergraduate. I had I got down to the end of my biology degree, and I needed 2 hours to graduate, and my biology department didn't have a 2-hour course, and so the chairman, chairwoman actually of the department, said, "Hey, Phil, you know, there's some staining kits up in the virology lab freezer. Go get them and stain something and write about it." And so I thought, well, heck, I could do that. And I had hired an accountant whose husband was a urology professor, a PhD urology professor at the University of Oklahoma, and they just moved there. And he had this very large animal model, and so I just asked her, you know, does Bob have any, you know, anything he wants to stain? And so he had an ongoing project, an NIH project, looking at, get this, the nature of the glycosaminoglycan layer of the mammalian bladder. And so he had this rat model, and he would denude it with acid, and he said, you know, we weren't planning on any histologic piece of this study, but why don't you take these bladders and see what you find? And so I took these bladders and at different stages of recovery from the insult, and we discovered how that glycosaminoglycan layer kind of progressively heals the interior of the bladder over time. And I wrote a paper about it, and he incorporated the paper, some of the paper, into his publication and put me as an author. And I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, this is easy. And so I thought, well, you know, I can do this. And so my very first paper actually was in urology. And it turns out that Bob's paper, Bob Hurst is his name, Robert Hurst, he that paper is still quoted as sort of the seminal basis of understanding of how that layer protects against cancers and stones and things like that. And it's still quoted today. It's pretty fascinating, but it sure looked easy to me from that perspective.
Yeah. Well, the first time, if you stumble upon that and you're like, oh, paper, you know,
yeah, exactly.
I'm sure, you know, it's easy to laugh about now, 'cause I'm sure, you know, better than most, you know, how difficult it is to get things published.
Well, it didn't turn out to be that easy going forward, to be honest with you. It does take a lot of perseverance.
Right.
Really thick skin and a real confidence, you know, not self-confidence, but assurance that, you know, this journey of hypothesis generation, testing and results, you know, is an open-ended piece. And albeit we're passionate and albeit we're personally involved and invested in the thought process, you know, always as scientists, we have to not marry our hypotheses. You know, we have to remember that a hypothesis is a suggestion of truth. And if we are able to investigate that, if we prove it wrong, then we have to recognize that our hypothesis was wrong. And it turns out that becomes very difficult for scientists sometimes, but can lead to a lot of wasted time. If you can't figure out, you know, I think the best piece of advice that I ever had was when I was doing my master's degree. So when I went to medical school, you know, that summer between your first and second year, you kind of doing whatever you do. And I was awarded a research scholarship at the University of Oklahoma to spend that 3 months in a lab focusing on whatever we want to focus on. And I knew, I was personal friends of the director of a lab, one of my mentors now, Robert Foreman, who discovered the neural mechanism. He was a neurophysiologist. Discovered the neural mechanism of referred pain. So, and he focused on angina, and he was mainly motivated because his father suffered from intractable angina, and he wanted to know why, when the heart hurts, do you feel it in the chest? You know, is there a reason? And so the convergence theory of, you know, nociception and central perceptions of where the pain is arising all came from his work. Not all of it, but was contributed to greatly by his work. And he had a lab that was very diverse. So part of the lab was a collaboration with a guy named Peter Schwartz, who was a world-renowned cardiologist from Milan, Italy, who had an interest in sudden death. He studied long QT syndrome, but he also developed an animal model of how the autonomic nervous system plays a role in the genesis of lethal arrhythmias, and how even predisposition to that could explain some of the unexplained sudden deaths that occur in people who seem to be quite healthy, even athletes that could be seem to be quite healthy. And so I, you know, the opportunity to spend 3 months in that lab was just like, wow, of course I will, you know? And so I spent 3 months in that lab and published a couple of papers, three or four papers that came out of that 3 months of work. The American Heart Association granted me a year's, time to, so I took a year between my second and third year of medical school and worked in that lab and earned a master's degree in physiology, neurophysiology. In my master's thesis, I focused on a couple of things, but the main thing I focused on I had animal model support, and I wrote the paper, submitted it to circulation, and the reviewer kind of trashed it. As you know, we I was amazed at that. You know, the cardiovascular community especially kind of eats its young. You know, if you're not, you know, Eugene Braunwald, then we can't, you know, we're going to destroy you and see how you do, see if you can tolerate that. And so they trashed it. And what happened was very nefarious, honestly. They took that idea and applied it to a human database that they had available, and published a paper about 6 months later that was exactly my master's thesis. And I got so upset by that. I was just like, how could that happen? Why would someone do that? And my mentor, Bob Foreman, said, look, Phil, if somebody steals your idea, think of that as the biggest compliment you've ever had. And if it's the only idea you have, then you need to find another job. And I'm like, wow, okay. You know, and so I learned early on that, yeah, we have our 10-year and 5-year goals, and we have those intermediate goals to get to those, or we should have those intermediate goals to get to where we want to be when we're, you know, but realizing that nobody can predict the future, and that the ability to understand how to look at a problem and focus on multiple different ways to approach that problem was key, and to always be looking for opportunities to, you know, to further that scientific endeavor. And I think Bob Foreman kind of personified that, to look at the big picture, always understanding there's multiple ways to understand the mechanisms of the big picture, and to never, you know, put all your eggs in one basket, so to speak.
Yep. So then when you finish med school, you know, we've talked a lot about the research career, but you know, kind of you're continued down the road in the autonomic physiology realm. Tell me more about that.
Yeah, so the animal model that I wound up being involved with very closely, it was a very long established animal model of sudden cardiac death, and it was a post-myocardial infarction sudden death. And I'll, you know, before you were born, the sudden death looked different than it does today. A sudden death occurred after myocardial infarction. We knew that about 15 to 20% of people who'd had a myocardial infarction would die suddenly in the next 12 months. I mean, the massive numbers. And sudden death, Bernard Laun, the famous cardiologist from Harvard, wrote a paper. The sudden death was cardiology's most important problem in the 70s. And we really were trying to figure out how can we establish risk mechanisms, and the other things that led to sudden death. Well, when I actually matriculated from the University of Oklahoma, and then joined, you know, continued my research programs through my residency and fellowship. You know, it was right about the time when we had completed the CAST trial, in which sodium channel blockers, which were known to suppress PVCs and non-sustained VTs, they would make it go away. It was incredible. But the trial was implemented right at the transition of coronary intervention. And so the balloon angioplasty and subsequently stenting and open arteries completely changed the face of sudden cardiac death. And so the anticipated incidence of sudden death in the CAST trial was around 15 to 20%. It turns out that in the control group, the incidence was around 5%. And the proarrhythmia of the sodium channel blockers was just enough to increase the risk of sudden death in the treatment group to around 6%, 6.5%. And so what the trial actually conclusion was that these sodium channel blockers increased the risk of sudden death, when if they had been done, you know, 5 years or 10 years earlier, it would have been, you know, a magnificent outcome. And so it was very clear that sudden death had changed its face, and it was a heart failure problem, because now people who traditionally 20% of people who would die suddenly are now living with coronary artery disease, with myocardial infarction, had developed heart failure, and heart failure incidence and prevalence started to increase dramatically. And when we thought about the people at risk, all of a sudden it was people who had ischemic disease, whose ejection fractions were reduced as a result of myocardial infarction. And those were the people then that suddenly became at risk in the target population. So the animal model that Peter had developed was antiquated. And so I developed a way to or help, you know, kind of copied some things that other people had done and developed a way to inject microspheres into the circulation of these animals to produce ischemic dilated cardiomyopathy and then study the autonomic process that went from, you know, ischemic disease all the way through heart failure. And then that gave us the opportunity to study these animals when they had no cardiovascular disease, characterize their autonomic nervous system, find out what myocardial infarction did to that and the control systems, and then what derangements led to arrhythmia risk as they developed heart failure. What changed? What was the difference? And we discovered a lot of stuff. In fact, we discovered that, you know, the predisposition for sudden cardiac death is innate. I mean, we're born with certain wiring of the autonomic nervous system, some of which can increase the risk of sudden death, even at the first myocardial infarction or first ischemic episode, even without myocardial infarction. People sometimes respond with chest pain. Some people respond with ventricular fibrillation. And a lot of the mechanism of that is because of the way the autonomic nervous system reacts to the perturbation of the myocardial injury. And modification of that process could lead to reducing the risk. So we were looking at mostly predicting risk, but also what things could we do to modify the nervous system that could lead to suppression of the arrhythmias that could lead to sudden death. And so I actually got into heart failure primarily because I was focused on sudden cardiac death and the disease itself, the thing I was trying to understand in terms of the autonomic milieu that led to risk was a heart failure problem. And so I had a heart failure model. And when I, you know, that was NIH funded and, you know, NIH was kind enough to fund my fellowship and all the other things that the NIH did, it really set me up personally to focus on heart failure as a clinician. And that was right at the time that, you know, we had shifted our thought process about heart failure from a completely hopeless, nothing we can do about a disease to understanding the fundamental reason the disease worsens over time and approaching that fundamental mechanism with ACE inhibitors and beta blockers. And now we have four pillars of therapies. And, you know, but I'll remind you that when I started, beta blockers were relatively contraindicated in patients with heart failure. And we had to figure out, you know, how do you deliver those therapies so that they aren't contraindicated and can be helpful. And so it was a really interesting time of evolution. And so when I joined the faculty at the University of Oklahoma, it was at the time when Greg Fonero and Lynn Stevenson had published their first paper on developing an organized disease management program for people with heart failure. And there were two or three centers in the country that had organized, dedicated heart failure disease management programs. And I decided we were going to set one up there at the University of Oklahoma fairly early on. And in fact, there was actually a more advanced program there in Tulsa at St. Francis many moons ago. And but to set up an ambulatory heart failure program was novel. No heart failure certification. And in fact, the first thing I had to encounter was the community looking at me and saying, we don't need a heart failure specialist. We all know how to take care of heart failure. And, you know, if I've heard that, if I had a dime for every time I heard that, I'd be a very rich man.
Yep. So, I know that you had some experience in the baroreceptor world, and I believe, if I'm not mistaken, you'd cross paths with my dad as well in this world. So tell me a little bit about that, because I think it's a neat story.
Yeah, so baroreflex sensitivity is a method where you challenge the central nervous system essentially with a peripheral blood pressure rise, and you watch the strength, so to speak, of the control of the parasympathetic nervous system to slow heart rate. That was the reflex, and we exploited that. Peter Slight and Smythe in the late 60s found that if you inject phenylephrine, the blood pressure rise was associated with a prolongation of the RR interval. And if you related the blood pressure rise to the subsequent RR interval prolongation, you could create a slope, a regression slope of that relationship. And the slope of that regression relationship kind of quantified the strength of the parasympathetic nervous system and its control over the heart. And baroreflex sensitivity was very complex. The baroreceptor physiology is very complex. It's hard to understand because there's gives and yins and yangs, and when you get into the nucleus tractus solitarius and you get disinhibition of the sympathetic nervous, it becomes counterintuitive, so you really have to think about how the baroreceptors control as a focus of the brain on control of the circulatory system. But we exploited that to try to understand, can we quantify the strength of the vagus? Because our hypothesis was, if there's an insult to the system, like myocardial infarction, if it, in those individuals that had very strong vagal reflexes survived, and in those people that did not have strong vagal reflexes died suddenly, and the balance at during the crisis of the sympathetic input to the ventricle as well as to the atrium, but very much in the context of the parasympathetic control, determined if the patient was going to survive or not, and or the individual would survive. And so there were probably, I think, maybe three or four labs in the world that were looking at that concept and other applications for understanding baroreceptor physiology. But your dad was a pioneer in the area and in a competing group.
Right. So he was at University of Iowa with Frank.
And so there was Frank Abboud and Alan Mark and your dad, and my mentor, Peter Schwartz, kind of got along with everybody, and we all had pretty similar hypotheses, but very nuanced differences in what we thought about. And I'll never forget the very first paper I ever presented in front of an audience as a medical student was at the NAT or at the Bi Association for Biology. I can't remember the acronym now of the meeting. But there are probably 200 people in the lab in the audience, and Alan Mark and Frank Abboud were in the front row. And what we'd done is we had fed these animals a very low sodium diet, which actually activated the renin-angiotensin system and the accentuated process between the sympathetic nervous system and angiotensin 2 completely changed the cardiac autonomic control. And so I reported that, and we could change a low risk individual to a very high risk individual for sudden death. And I presented that, and every time I'll never forget, every time I would make a proposition or a conclusion, and this is what, 15 minutes, and Frank Abboud would hear that and he'd drop his head and shake his head. He's on the front row, and I'm thinking, oh my God, I'm making a fool of myself, the whole time. But we actually got to know him, and I think that's just the way Frank treated everybody. But it was a very tight-knit group, and we all, I think, had the same goals and the same, it's just and frankly, anything like that has to be contributed to by collaborators, but also competitors. You can't, you always have to have someone thinking that the hypothesis is right or wrong. You can't be married to the hypothesis, and the tendency is to be married to the hypothesis. If you don't have somebody out there counterbalancing that enthusiasm, that's dangerous. And so you have to learn that those kinds of interactions where you have conflict or where you have people that are challenging what you have to say is not is not to discourage you, but to encourage you to build or test or prove it or not, you know. And I think that community was incredible. And learned a lot from your dad, and learned a lot from his group, and it was that sort of caliber. It works in science when you have people who are not a part of your institution that are in the same field, that are looking at maybe even the same hypothesis from a different perspective, and that perspective is critical for truth to, and you know, this always has the end game of helping patients. You know, if you lose sight of that, then it becomes a job, you know. But if your end point is always, how do I help somebody live longer, not die suddenly, get, you know, a better quality of life, then that's the end game. And you know, I've now had a very diverse career, and every single segment of my career has been anchored on the thought, I am here to help people, you know, get better with a horrible disease. And you know, that, and I think we all had that in our minds when we were investigating these mechanisms.
Yeah. So tell me about this. You've had some career transitions. You obviously were at OU, and then eventually were at Abbott after that, or I don't know if there's anything in between, but tell me about that transition, or how the opportunity arose, or what you thought about it, if you got advice or mentorship along the way or whatnot.
I think the transitions, as I mentioned, were about 10-year transitions, and I didn't, like I said, I didn't have that as a goal. It just happened. And, you know, many of the things that I've had happen in my career have been just simply having my eyes open for opportunities, and understanding the risks, but not being afraid of them. And that, I think, is key. I think, you know, people sometimes look at risks and they're afraid of those, and that tempers too much their thought process and their opportunity to take advantage of opportunities right there in front of them that could evolve their career to where they need to be. So as I recommend to students and to young people, you know, you gotta have a 10-year plan, you know, but remember that 10-year plan is the best you can think about right now. And you now have a direction, you have intermediate goals, and you always have to see where the opportunities are to take a different track that you didn't know about when you set the 10-year plan. And one of the things that happened as I was on faculty at the university, it was very clear that NIH funding had changed. It was becoming very, very competitive. I think my last NIH grant, the threshold for funding was like at the 9th percentile. And then I had a large animal model that was very expensive, and the NIH had shifted to focus on genetic studies and very small animal stuff and petri dishes and stuff like that. So me being competitive, you know, having a part-time job in the lab and a part-time job in our full-time job in the clinical realm was very, very difficult. And so I started to understand how I could sort of go more into the translational, you know, from bench to bedside is an important process, but there are certain steps that occur to make it successful. And I realized that I needed to become more adept and acquainted with how do you take these concepts into clinical medicine, and shifted my emphasis on, you know, being involved in clinical trial generation, early data supporting the development of clinical trial generation, and actually left the faculty after about 10 years on faculty, probably, you know, however many years from the time I went to medical school, residency and internship and you know, fellowship, many, many years there. I went to a private group in Oklahoma City that had formed a physician-owned hospital called Oklahoma Heart Hospital. And the intent was, could I set up a disease management program at an academic center, translate that to a private center to try to encourage the formal organized management of people with heart failure. And so I spent about 10 years there. And my research interest then shifted to developing, you know, clinical devices and algorithms that could help people with heart failure. At that time, got involved with a clinical development of a hemodynamic monitoring system, which was actually kind of interesting in my mind, because I started in the MIRACLE trial to look at a concept called heart rate variability, which just simply measures the R to R intervals and quantifies the variability. I mean, that was the focus of my master's degree, and we always try to figure out how could we get a better signal to manage these calculations of heart rate variability. And high heart rate variability is created by strong vagal control of the heart. So the vagus is very interested in every single heartbeat and the interval between it. And so if you have strong vagal control, your heart rate variability becomes very high. And I with Bill Abraham, was able to get involved at Medtronic with the MIRACLE trial, the first trial with cardiac resynchronization therapy that led to FDA approval of that device, and took the signals from the atrial lead and said, let's just process those signals and output a physiologic parameter, heart rate variability. And so we did two studies, one in the MIRACLE trial and one in the NSYNC registry, which was the post-market registry that was generated after the MIRACLE trial, and investigated the use of heart rate variability. Because what I had discovered in the disease management of patients with heart failure is that if I could spend the whole hypothesis that Greg Fonaro and Lynn Stevenson thought about was, if you just focused on these patients and attended to them and developed an algorithm for their care, you would help them. And what I realized very quickly was there were 5,000 patients in my clinic. And if I spent every day with them, I'd be in the hospital. You know, I might keep them out of the hospital, but it would kill me. And there was no earthly way I could spend enough time, because, you know, the sliver of time that we spend with a patient compared to them living out there with heart failure is just nothing. And so the frustration part of my career managing people with heart failure was, I knew that if I could just get insight into what was happening when I couldn't see them, we could possibly change the trajectory of that process. And so we did the heart rate variability process simply because we could then remotely monitor that. And we discovered that, yep, heart rate variability changes when people start to get sick. And we discovered for the first time that there was a physiologic change that predated a hospitalization by nearly 3 weeks. It was 19 days on average, that you could detect significant changes in heart rate variability long before patients got sick and came to you and said, I'm having an exacerbation. And so it triggered in our minds that if we were able to remotely monitor these people with a physiologic actionable signal, we might be able to keep them well and out of the hospital. And so the heart rate variability piece was the first iteration of that. The next iteration, you know, it was funny because everybody at Heart Rhythm Society, when we published those abstracts, all they could talk about was heart rate variability, heart rate variability. And then about 6 months later, everybody came back and said, Adamson, what do we do with this? You know, because what do we change the beta blocker? Do we change the diuretic? What does this mean? And so there was this picture of a change in physiology that was unactionable. And it didn't help to have the remote monitoring heart rate variability because you didn't know what to do. And even if you brought the patient in, they wouldn't have any symptoms. They wouldn't have any signs that they were worsening. This predated any signs of congestion, any physical signs and any symptoms. And so you'd bring them in, they'd say, I'm fine. Why'd you bring me in? I'm definitely not taking more of those diuretics. So you didn't have any, you know, you didn't have any way to actually avert the catastrophe.
Right.
And so, you know, we then had the hypothesis that filling pressures led to symptoms and led to exacerbation. Congestion was the key. And so we collaborated with Medtronic to develop an implantable hemodynamic monitoring system called the Chronicle, which was a pacemaker-like device that continuously measured right ventricular hemodynamics. We developed an algorithm that could estimate the pulmonary artery diastolic pressure, which in most patients is equal to the wedge pressure. And so we felt we could bring an ambulatory wedge, essentially, that could be monitored 24/7. The great thing about it is it monitored 24/7. The horrible thing about it is it monitored 24/7. It was like, yep. Holy cow, what do we do with all this? And no one had ever seen such things. And so Mike Zile and Bill Abraham and I all sat down, I'll never forget, and took a week and just put our fingers through this data and tried to understand these patterns. And what we discovered is now 25 days before patients get sick and come in the hospital, if you took the hospitalization scan back with continuous monitoring, you could find these changes that would predate, you know, by 3 weeks, the whole decompensation process. And so the remote monitoring world started to morph into to understanding the physiology, understanding the hemodynamics, and developing something we could monitor that we could actually do something about.
Right. And it was actually actionable in this case.
And the Chronicle device, it turns out was based on old technology and kind of failed too often for FDA to approve the technology, but the little things we learned about physiology were amazing. And at the time, you know, the technology had developed into a microelectromechanical system and a tiny sensor that could be permanently implanted in the pulmonary artery, and we could now, not necessarily every minute of every day, measure hemodynamics, but we can measure it every day and under the same conditions. And so we could then develop trends that could alert people that things are changing. And then we knew why. We knew what to do. And so there were really four concepts that came out of that the signal had to be a reflection of the underlying pathophysiology that was important in the thing you're trying to prevent. The signal had to tell you what to do. And then it had to, you know, essentially monitor if what you did is working and give you an adequate amount of time before to avert whatever it is you're trying to prevent, whether that be hospitalizations or whatever. And so, you know, we learned that the signal with remote monitoring had to have certain characteristics for it to be useful clinically. And then the CardioMEMS system was developed to really make the system much more usable, rather than, you know, putting in a pacemaker-like device. You could just drop this thing in the pulmonary artery, and the CHAMPION trial was started. And I had the grand opportunity to collaborate with Bill Abraham to be the co-PI of that trial to design it. I actually did the first CardioMEMS implant in North America, and we'd had, I think, 12 implants in Ecuador or someplace in South America, and then we designed the trial and implemented it, and the rest of the story is that led to FDA approval and the subsequent battle then to convince the world that was useful.
Yes, a constant struggle in some senses, but you know, I think that the transition in the heart failure remote monitoring space is, if you're monitoring something, you're not necessarily providing a therapy. And so there needs to be something on the back end, whether it's built in or whether it's clinician based or whether it's systems based, but ultimately it comes into, how are you implementing this in your system? And so I, you know, the new focus on implementation science overlaid on, you know, you could be very good at measuring something, and, you know, this whole signal to noise ratio, which you kind of alluded to, is, you know, is having 24/7 data a feature or a bug, maybe a little bit of both. How do you actually comb through all this? And then did you just burden your clinic or your workflow with all this thing, and you're picking a needle out of haystack with what you're actually going to do with it? All these things, you know, now with technology improving in parallel, I think we've certainly turned the corner. And you know, I'm obviously newer to the game in this, but it's very fascinating to hear the early stages.
I will tell you that early on, the end game was to put this in the hands of the patient. You know, we always thought this was a glucose monitor for diabetes, and you know, the algorithms really can be created by the physician and put in the hands of the patient. If an 80-year-old or a 70-year-old can draw up insulin and inject it into themselves and not kill themselves, then, you know, an algorithm could be developed to take care of the volume shifts that lead to PA pressure rises before a decompensation event. And so, you know, in the interim, we developed another device that actually was implanted in the interatrial septum, measured left atrial pressure, and gave the patient their left atrial pressure every day. We built an algorithm that, you know, if this, then that type algorithm, and patients just loved it, and they did very well. The problem was the implantation. You had to do a transseptal, and at that time that wasn't very common, and complications, and we had CardioMEMS, and it was just, you know, there was a controversial but summation of the decision not to continue that trial. But the whole design was the what we felt was the end game, which the patient was the one who took the data, could act on it without my prescription. And we called it physician-directed patient self-management. Bill Abraham came up with that cool name, but it was really, you know, can this become a glucose for diabetes? And take the doctor and other than, you know, formulating the algorithm, the prescription to respond to those changes. I mean, we, you know, for a long, long time, we had people respond to daily weight changes, you know, with intensification of diuretics. I mean, for goodness sake, the sensitivity specificity of daily weight changes is almost zero. And you know, and what we discovered with hemodynamic monitoring is that there it wasn't exogenous volume that caused people to get a problem. It was redistribution of sequestered compartmentalized volume that actually caused people to go down that pathway to decompensation. And you know, if you move, you know, volume from one compartment to the other, the daily weight doesn't change. It's all internal. And so, you know, the tools we were using were we thought were the best were really not reflecting the underlying pathophysiology.
And so the trial that you were alluding to is Laptop HF, and
Right.
in combination with Champion and Guide HF, you know, the more recent meta-analyses that were published in the last few years really show strong support for reduction in mortality and heart failure hospitalizations, you know, in those cohorts. And I think that large practices that are using CardioMEMS or PA pressure monitoring systems do have fantastic results with keeping patients out of the hospital, preventing decompensations by preventing you know, congestion from occurring before it becomes a problem, before they develop, you know, renal failure, et cetera. So
Yeah, and you hit the nail on the head. If you know, it's a tree falling in the forest without anybody around if you don't look at the pressures. And so having and it's not that hard. I mean, we build an infrastructure to manage heart failure patients that's very inefficient. I had two full-time people answering phone calls of my heart failure patients. I followed about 5,500 patients, and that's all they did, 8 hours a day. I had to have a psychologist help them every month to deal with where they were nurses, and they were, you know, they wanted to see people, and it's just a massive inefficiency when you're just trying to sort through symptoms and social and all that stuff over the telephone. But you know, we had the infrastructure. If you just redirect that to a much more efficient way to manage the patients, then it's not an infrastructure build that's onerous, but you have to have it currently. That's why I think, you know, putting these data in the patient's hands for action makes it, you know, they're vested. They want to get better. And so, you know, that immediate feedback really does create a sense of security as well as control. And I think those are key elements of how people get better.
Yeah, and it, you know, kind of gives that element of patient empowerment, which I think we talk about a lot now, and you know, we've seen it in a number of different ways, whether it be Epic HF and Larry Allen's group showing that if patients were coming in with a list of, you know, their GDMT and what you're going to up titrate at the next visit, that it helps get them on better therapy. And I think that, you know, to your point, really trying to figure out how do we amplify our effects as clinicians, because you know, you can see the person that's directly in front of you, and you can spend 15 minutes and you can have a great conversation, but 15 minutes is a sliver of time for them. And you know, when you have thousands of patients that you're taking care of, you just can't spend all that time.
That you can't. And you know, you're right. Scalability for heart failure care is the key element. And that was part of the motivation that led me at least into the development of remote monitoring technologies. The data stream becomes an issue, but you know, now with advanced analytics and other things, you know, it's just ripe for, you know, an AI monitoring process or machine learning to cluster phenotypes. And you know, it's you know, you have to skate to where the puck's going to be, you know. And I didn't know AI was going to come about, but certainly knew that there was there there that the infrastructure challenge that many people cite as I can't do this because of, you know, that hurdle is surmountable. And you know, the value, as you mentioned, of being able to thoughtfully and physiologically based manage these patients on a regular basis makes this whole thing scalable. And again, if you're focusing on the patient outcome, then you get motivated to set these things up.
And it's so interesting hearing this from you, because in parallel, when my intern year at Penn State, working with John Boehmer on the heart failure service, we had these discussions about heart logic, and MultiSense was a couple of years off of being published, and we had these discussions, and I was like, well, so what is the best way to monitor people? And I did this whole literature review, and not even knowing like that this was the tip of the iceberg and that I would get so into heart failure remote monitoring down the line. But I ended up like coming up with the idea of this meta-analysis as an intern, basically comparing thoracic impedance to pressure guided monitoring, and the RCT data, you know, heavily favoring the pressure guided monitoring. And then that got me into hemodynamics and right heart casts, and the love of that blossomed. And now that's like my favorite thing that I'll talk for days about. But it's really interesting to hear about the source of it. And it makes perfect sense, right? You're trying to figure out how to help the most amount of people in the simplest fashion. Detect problems before they get admitted, detect problems before they get symptoms, intervene early. I mean, this is all the preventative medicine angle that is being talked about so much. Heart failure really is you need to be working on prevention, because there's so many people that are now living longer that are developing heart failure and all these things. We're getting saturated as a community taking care of these folks. But fortunately, we have a lot of good therapies from pharmacotherapy and these intermediate devices. And we haven't really even gotten to talked about the end stage heart failure, but I think that's the next transition. And I'm curious, you know, because you've been in this phase of seeing the VAD space progress from the early days of HeartMate and HeartMate 2 and now HeartMate 3 and all these things. So, tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, and just to fill in the blank there, it turns out that when I became interested in taking care of people with heart failure, there was no board certification for it. And as I mentioned, nobody believed that we needed people like me. And, Bill Abraham and I had that frustration at our institutions and saw very brilliant people leaving, you know, heart failure, loving it, but leaving heart failure to EP and interventional because it was more organized and because they had procedures and other things. And so we developed a curriculum of training that we published, I think, in 2004, that outlined a way you could build a heart failure specialist that incorporated the implantation at that time of cardiac resynchronization therapy and what we saw with hemodynamic monitoring. And that then led to ABIM certifying heart failure. But what they said in this negotiation was that they test all that stuff with CRT and all the ICDs. They test all that stuff on other tests. The only thing that they could put into a test that would be unique for this heart failure certification was the treatment of advanced heart failure, which was absolutely not what Bill and I had in mind when we developed this curriculum. And because what it did was it polarized, you know, heart failure management to the end stage of heart failure. And so that's where expertise comes into play. And it actually did opposite of what we wanted, which was to say heart failure expertise comes into a major play prior to the development of advanced heart failure. And so it, you know, the advent of board certification in my mind, could have been done a little bit differently and incorporated certification for people who focus solely on keeping people from becoming advanced. Mm-hmm. The community, I recognize that the breakthroughs we had with Champion and with Compass HF and Laptop HF and Reduce HF, all of those breakthroughs would then have to hit the community and the inertia of us of and the heterogeneity of care for people with heart failure was going to be really a difficult thing when people tried to commercialize this. And had the opportunity, was given the opportunity. I didn't want it. I actually suggested to St. Jude Medical, who purchased CardioMEMS, that they needed to have somebody that could navigate the heart failure community, because they just knew the EP community and they are totally different. Because I was, you know, as part of the EP community, and then, you know, kind of straddled over to heart failure and got into the heart failure community with the sudden death background. And I said, man, these folks are much different. And if you don't have somebody who understands that, you're not going to be successful. And they came back about 6 months after that conversation and said, we figured it out. You're the guy. I'm like, I have the best job in heart failure. Are you crazy? I'm not going to join, go leave. I wound up realizing that innovation was going to be discarded, because nobody was going to have the perseverance to make it work. And to overcome, you know, to do the other trials that were required, like Guide HF and other trials. And so I decided to change my career to go into industry. But again, I never felt I had changed my mind. I was always the same Phil, you know, and my focus was always the same. What can I help this patient get and do? But the magnitude of scale became much different. I go from 5,000 to 20 million, and you know, the potential for scope of impact became totally different. And so I joined St. Jude Medical, who then acquired Thoratec. I was, it was a very unique story. We don't have time for that one, but we at St. Jude Medical acquired Thoratec, and shortly thereafter, Abbott acquired us as St. Jude Medical. To incorporate the heart failure division into the Abbott megalith. You know, it's a $220 billion market cap company, 135 years old. I mean, it's a big, big, amazing company, very good culture, very, very unique company. And then had the opportunity to be chief medical officer there of the heart failure division, as you mentioned, in charge of HeartMate 3, Centromag, and CardioMEMS. And the HeartMate 3 story is fascinating. You know, the original thought behind a mechanical circulatory support device was, can we get somebody in shock to survive long enough to transplant them? You know, we'll get them in the unit, we'll put a LVAD in them, maybe they'll survive, we'll get a heart, and we'll transplant them. And everybody said we'd use it in everybody if we could just get them out to the floor, because it's very expensive in the ICU. So we got, you know, the first patient was discharged out of the intensive care unit to the step down unit, and everybody applauded and said, oh my God, that's magnificent. And then they said, you know, we use this in everybody if you could just get the patient out of the hospital, because it's taken a long time to find an organ. And Bob Cormos discharged the very first patient with an LVAD to an apartment down the street from UPMC with an engineer and a nurse and FDA and the police. I mean, it was just crazy. And so everybody applauded. Oh my God, we sent a patient home. And they said, well, you know, if we could get them out of the apartment without the nurse and the engineer, maybe that would, and you didn't have to carry the refrigerator around with them to keep it going, that would be even better. We'd use it in everybody. So HeartMate 2 came along, and it was just magnificent. You know, people were surviving 15 years. It was unbelievable. And so everybody said, oh my gosh, you know, we would use this in everybody if it just didn't have this pump thrombosis problem. And so, you know, the magnetically levitated magic of watching that rotor just suspend in midair and start spinning and not, you know, have minimum contact with the blood pool, no pump thrombosis. And everybody's like, yay, this is amazing. And we use it in everybody if you could just get rid of the driveline, you know? And so at every iteration of this unbelievable engineering, I mean, the engineers that develop these are just unbelievably brilliant people. But each iteration, the community had, if this wasn't present, we would use it in everybody. And so it became we realized we were chasing an unattainable future. And so it kind of dampened, honestly, the desire to spend more money to develop those. But, you know, I will tell you, through the Momentum 3 process that compared HeartMate 2 to HeartMate 3, that iterative improvement in survival and quality of life. And, you know, okay, I have a driveline and I carry a backpack with me, but, you know, I'm alive and I can walk 400 meters in 6 minutes and I can see my grandchildren. I can, you know, the patient outcomes there was just unbelievably fulfilling. I mean, these are people who are dead, you know, and you know, even today, the Intermax registry would suggest we're using VADs in Intermax 1, 2, and 3s. And then, you know, Intermax 1s are people going to be dead in a week, you know, or less than that. And, you know, they're living 10, 15 years with this device. And, you know, you talk to them and say, this is fantastic. Now, okay, they'd say, we'd love not to have the driveline, but the alternative is, you know, I'd look really good in the casket, you know. So I mean, this has been one of the most amazing engineering feats
right.
that I've been able to witness, that I think could be scaled to a lot more people, if applied a little earlier. And that's why the TeamHF trial was developed, because we discovered the pathophysiology of heart failure is really different than what we thought. It was, you know, we thought the filling pressures drove the whole thing. Well, we turned out to filling pressures are the same in class 2, 3, and 4 patients in the guide HF trial. They were exactly the same.
Right.
The difference between a class 2 and a class 4 patient was really the development of RV uncoupling and early dysfunction that couldn't be clinically identified.
Yes.
And so it occurred to me that we as cardiologists are allowing a disease to metastasize, and the metastasis caused the symptoms, and we trigger our therapies based on the symptoms. So we allow the disease to metastasize before we would start to treat it. And so we developed the TeamHF trial to really understand which patients would benefit from early offloading of the left ventricle to keep them from developing severe pulmonary hypertension that killed the right ventricle, which then caused the refractory symptoms that we then triggered an advanced heart failure definition. And so I hope that that process is going to be very successful and will clarify, you know, where is the line to be drawn to physiologically based understand when a patient is traversing into advanced heart failure and could benefit from LV offloading and treat the disease before it metastasizes.
Right. Yeah. I think it'll be very interesting to see results of that. Like you said, you know, the congestion, the filling pressures are the same despite, you know, your NOHA class, which is obviously not a super sensitive metric, but we use it nonetheless. But I think the way that you emphasize the metastasis, you know, because we talk a lot about the overlap between heart failure and, you know, the oncology space, and, you know, whether it's talking about GDMT versus chemotherapy, whether it's talking about, you know, end stage, you know, heart replacement therapies and whatnot. But, you know, this metastatic, you know, left heart disease causing pulmonary hypertension or RV failure and all these things, I think, you know, we're talking about it more and it's still under-recognized, but I think it's a very important thing to key in on, because it probably could delineate, you know, who's having symptoms and who's not and who needs earlier therapy and who doesn't.
Well, and you know, I all along in my career, I've been astounded by the disconnect between symptoms and the underlying pathophysiology. Like, things are the body has this mechanism, multiple mechanisms to accommodate perturbations, and the accommodation internally keeps the symptoms from developing. And so you have this disease percolating that's not causing symptoms, but we train ourselves to trigger every treatment on symptoms and justify the risks of treatments based on the alleviation of symptoms. And if truth be told, you know, the underlying mechanisms are much more important to focus on than the symptoms. I mean, that, you know, coming full circle now, you know, I'm at CBRX and back into the autonomics world. And that has been one of the most enjoyable pieces of the last 2 years, has been to really now focus back on how does this autonomic nervous system cause the progression
right.
to advanced heart failure? And can we fundamentally approach that with a neurostimulatory technique that, you know, we are in the 21st century, so we should be able to think about technologies that could alter the nervous system, like Elon Musk is doing with patients, quadriplegic patients and blind patients. We're going to say he's going to make the blind see. Are you kidding me? And so if we embrace that kind of in technology to understand how we can fundamentally change the body's response that becomes maladaptive, we're no longer having to focus on surrogate markers of the mechanism. We're focusing on the mechanism. And secondary pulmonary hypertension is a prime example of that. You know, we found that 82% of patients who had class two, New York Heart Association class two heart failure, 82% of them had serious secondary pulmonary hypertension. It went unnoticed. Nobody knew. I wouldn't have gone and done a right heart cath in a virtually asymptomatic patient who hadn't had medicine changes or anything like that. I'd have pat myself on the back and told the patient how great their doctor was, you know? And I think we understood that secondary pulmonary hypertension was important, but we didn't have anything to do for it. And so, you know, one of the, I think, most important pieces of new thought process is how much is tone developing in the pulmonary circulation that causes that secondary pulmonary hypertension, and what drives that tone. And there have been four or five companies that have developed ablative techniques for the pulmonary artery to kill the sympathetic nerves around the pulmonary artery, just like renal nerve denervation. It's pulmonary artery denervation to treat secondary pulmonary hypertension. And so what I'm excited about is investigating the possibility that if you change the reason the sympathetic tone is high to the pulmonary artery, you might have a significant impact on secondary pulmonary hypertension that could lead, I think, to a sort of slowing the progression of the disease and maybe even preventing that RV involvement in the end-stage process. So it's really, I think, a matter of focus on what really matters, and that is why does this disease progress over time? And to understand that fundamental reason, you can focus on altering that fundamental reason.
You know, you took away my transition.
Sorry.
For you to say, oh, you know, coming full circle, tell me about what you're doing now. But you kind of, you know, I'll take credit because I led you into it indirectly. But, that's how, you know, we got to know each other over the last few years, and, you know, fortunate enough to help run Heart Failure Fellows course and, you know, help usher in the next generation of heart failure clinicians, or even just cardiology fellows that are interested in heart failure, because there's so much overlap, no matter what you're going into, if it's interventional and structural or EP, you know, there's this intersections between all of these, and those lines are blurring more and more. You really need to know what's going on in all fields, and there's so much innovation and everything like that. And frankly, I think it is really fascinating. Also, with my background and you know, my father's history in baroreceptors, it's this kind of very, very unique access that put us in the same room together and find out all this history. But I think that one of the neat things about you know, the baroreceptors or barostim therapy and whatnot is kind of how I want you to explain your analogy from a rainstorm, an umbrella, and everything like that between GDMT for heart failure versus other ways of augmenting.
It's an easy transition because Phil hasn't changed his focus at any level throughout these transitions. The world looks and says, Phil's changed to this. Clyde Gansey told me, we knew you were crazy, but we didn't think you were that crazy. And, you know, to me, I've never changed. I've never changed anything. It's always been focused on the same end goal. And it strikes me that we really don't need to be cardiologists. We need to be pathophysiologists. If we understand that everything is linked, an electrophysiologist shouldn't be the right retinal specialist. You know, they should be a cardiologist that looks at the electrical system of the heart, but knowing full well that the mechanical system, the autonomic nervous system, the circulatory system, the blood flow, everything affects this. And you have to understand how it affects it in order to really understand your career. And so, you know, coming back to the baroreceptors was really fun for me, because when you think of the neurohormonal hypothesis, which came about in 1992 when I was, you know, setting up the heart failure disease management program. We shifted from this being a hemodynamic stress model of progression to a neurohormonal model that acts, you know, the maladaptive neurohormonal model. And we take that for granted. I mean, everybody knows that. And so we know that if we apply antagonists to that those systems, that we prolong life and prevent progression. And, you know, I'll never forget when I first, you know, started being involved in the U.S. carvedilol trials, I'd go out and talk about beta blockers and heart failure and report that we're seeing ventricles improve. And I had people laugh at me, you know, saying that's not possible. The heart can never improve. And you know, to have watched the pathophysiologic understanding and interventions actually change the underlying disease was really fascinating. And so when you step back and say, well, why do we get neurohormonal activation? Then you have to go back to what the baroreceptor sees when it's monitoring the circulatory system. And remember that the brain's most important priority is circulation. And I said that at the very beginning. The brain knows that circulation in the heart's the most important system in all of the body. And you know, it's not just cardiologists that say that. It's the brain that says that too.
Right.
And so all of the monitoring to ensure cardiovascular health is monitored literally on a beat-to-beat basis. And it's monitored through the signal that's transduced through the baroreceptor. And so the stretch that baroreceptors signal, you know, activates a nerve called the carotid sinus nerve that goes to the nucleus tractus solitarius and the hypothalamus, all that stuff. But that threat center really feels like circulation or perfusion are the most important thing to monitor. And so all of the receptors that tell the brain the status is, you know, are amalgamated at that level, and then the response to the perceived threat is keeps us alive if we're stuck on a desert island or dehydrated or hemorrhaged. Well, in heart failure, that's not, you know, the interpretation of the brain is that I'm dehydrated, I'm hemorrhaged. Well, that's not the right answer. It's a maladaptive interpretation of the signal. And so that flood of adrenergic activation and renin angiotensin activation, all the other things that happen, inflammation, all of that occurs as a result of this originating signal that the brain uses to monitor the circulation. And so when we use the drugs that we use, we get to the interface between the autonomic nervous system and the organ, and we antagonize that end product of toxicity. Right. And so we shield, essentially. It's like, as I've said before, it's like putting an umbrella up in a rainstorm. You're going to get wet, you know, but you're not going to get as wet. Right. If you could turn off the storm, then that's a totally different perspective. And so what we've discovered is, if, you know, the way the brain sees heart failure is a decrease in nerve firing in the carotid sinus nerve, and it activates all these emergency maladaptive reflexes. And by going into that nerve and artificially electrically increasing its nerve activity essentially tells the central nervous system, the threat center, that, hey, look, things aren't this bad. Stop activating the sympathetic nervous system. Restore parasympathetic control. Inflammation needs to drop. We're not in a crisis. This is the, you know, it just resets the whole process. And so instead of just using an umbrella to shield the organ, we actually decrease the storm. And what we're discovering, and we're now, as you know, embarking on the largest clinical trial that's ever been done in the device realm, called Benefit HF, and what we're discovering is that even people, and I don't know if you've read yet, it just came out and very recently the new consensus for definition of heart failure that the ACC and AHA wrote, with Minna Walsh as the first author, essentially saying, look, we need to think of ejection fraction a little bit differently. That if the ejection fraction is not normal, if it is low, that's heart failure. And that's what I think is true, is that when the ejection fraction, when the heart performance is not normal, that's being perceived by the brain as a problem. And this whole neurohormonal cascade to certain levels is being activated. And as I mentioned to you very first, we discovered many years ago that we're all wired a little bit differently. And so in some people, that is going to lead to sudden death. That's going to lead to sudden death with a mid-range ejection fraction. It's going to lead to progression of disease. And so we're testing whether modulation of the nervous system through baroreceptor activation therapy actually will benefit people with EFs less than 50%, you know, and moving this early into the heart failure syndrome. And so, you know, this I think is very congruent with what the community thinks about what heart failure really is, how we may have not, should have maybe not defined it based on ejection fraction, but instead based on the underlying pathophysiology. And I believe we'll see that the addressing the storm is a superior way to deal with this disease than just shielding the organs from the storm.
Well, I applaud you and CVRX for taking on this kind of massive undertaking of running such a large trial. I mean, normally we're used to maybe a couple hundred patients in these device trials. And what's the target enrollment for Benefit HF?
2,500 randomized patients. Lord have mercy. You know, when we did Guide HF, there was 1,000 patients randomized, and people thought I'd lost my mind when I designed that one. And I'm sure now people have convinced that I should be institutionalized, but it's a big undertaking. You're right. I mean, you can't do something like this without, you know, counting the cost. Right. Both monetary as well as effort. And but you know, I've been really pleased to have a lot of support, both from the community and from my company, to actually do this. Because you're right, we've in devices for a variety of reasons, and I've kind of written a couple of papers about that. You know, the cost, the risk, the equipoise, all the stuff in a device trial is much different than a drug trial. And so drug trials set the standard of 5,000 patients followed for 5 years with mortality as a primary endpoint. Well, devices have never been able to do that. And I understand why, but when we designed this trial, I was not willing to do another trial that inadequately tests the hypothesis, and to realistically test the hypothesis that we're testing in this trial, Benefit HF, you know, you really have to have a large number of patients follow for 2 years to understand, does mortality, I mean, you saw it with hemodynamic monitoring. Fascinatingly, we saw no difference in mortality at 12 months, none in any of the trials. And when you follow people out for 2 years, all of a sudden, just like in the tafamidis trial, just about 14, 15, 16 months, that mortality outcome splays out dramatically different. But if you stop your monitoring at a year, you're never going to see the signal. And so, you know, in these days and times, with all the therapies we have to influence outcomes, it's going to have to be a longer term outcome. So 2,500 patients followed for 2 years is a magnum opus in the device trial world. So we're very excited about it, but realize that this is a lot of work between now and
then. We're super excited about it, you know, myself personally, and also, you know, I think just as a heart failure community. And, you know, we've had success with some Barostim patients here at Oklahoma Heart Institute. And I know we've kind of discussed a little bit about the one case of you know, patient having more exercise capacity and doing invasive CPETs pre and post Barostim therapy, and basically the follow up, they were able to exercise for twice as many watts. They went from like 40 to 80 or something like that, almost up to 100 watts, and their wedge pressure was half, which is just a fascinating.
That story changed my life, man. I'm telling you, that patient's outcome was. That put it all together, because you know what we have to start thinking about is this disease is a systemic disease. You know, it's multifactorial systemic disease, and you have to have a systemic intervention to adequately change the things that lead to badness. And that patient who taught me so much sort of indirectly, you know, variety of different things, was a fantastic example of how neuromodulation changes so many things. It changes the pulmonary artery response left atrial response, the ventricular response, the heart rate response, the exercise capacity, all the things that go into the physiology, all of a sudden it makes very clear you have to be a pathophysiologist to understand all this stuff. And, exactly. And all of those components were in play in that one case report. It's just fantastic.
Yeah, we're, you know, hopefully tying up, finishing writing it up, and we can get it out publicly sooner than later. But yeah, I'm super, super excited about that. You know, this has been a fantastic conversation. I've enjoyed every second of it. The nerd in me talking about heart rate variability. I mean, you and I could talk about that for an hour alone with baroreceptors, obviously heart failure have that in common. But I think, you know, some of the key highlights from our conversation that I want to point out. One is you highlighted how your career has shifted kind of in 10-year chunks, but that's almost like the one way of looking at it. But at the same time, it hasn't shifted at all, that you've been the same person. And it's just kind of whether it's a different application or, you know, maybe working at a different place, different environment, but still with the same goal in mind. And so it changed in 10-year chunks, but also hasn't changed at all, which I think is fascinating.
And I do too, because I think the environment in which you work does sort of mold how you think. And frankly, when I went in the industry, I learned so much more than I never thought I would know or ever even thought about. Yep. You know, international regulation and international reimbursement and all those other things. It's just been amazing learning.
And FDA and everything like that.
Yeah. Right? I mean, it's an amazing experience. Honestly, I wouldn't trade it for the world. I wouldn't have any regrets looking back of anything, even the decisions of, you know, say, of not listening to good advice. I mean, that to me, a failure is not a failure. It's just simply, you know, an opportunity to figure out how to do it right. And I have absolutely not a second of regret for any of the things. Even if I look back and say, well, yeah, that was boneheaded to do, but you know, I learned that was boneheaded.
I mean, you learn from your mistakes, right?
Yeah.
You know, and you just, as long as you don't keep on making the same mistake.
That's the key. That's the key. You gotta accept the hypothesis that I'm married to may not be the right one. You know, number two, you have to always have your eyes open for opportunities that could, maybe you didn't even anticipate, like going into industry. I never anticipated I'd ever do that. But it was an opportunity to see this technology go from, you know, clinical trial to the world. And that was not going to be easy. And I knew that somebody had with a passion had to be there. And, you know, it was a great opportunity to learn more and to further that environment. And then to see the opportunity to now go back to where I started and to fundamentally change the response of the autonomic nervous system. I mean, Lord have mercy, who gets to do that at this age? You know, it's almost criminal, you know. I can't believe I have that opportunity and to love what I do but those opportunities, you know, they many times pop up, and it's kind of the red car phenomenon. You know, you don't know how many red cars you saw this morning, but if you ask how many red cars do you see coming into work tomorrow, you're going to know exactly how many red cars. If you're not aware that the opportunities are popping up in front of you, then you don't ever get to take the ones you want. And I, you know, it's been a wonderful ride. And if I died suddenly today, that'd be all right, because you know what? I've had a life that's been fantastic. You know, I've got a great family, great life. And my career has, to your point, never really deviated from, can I make that poor patient that I look into their eyes, you know, 25, 30 times a day for 20 years, can I finally make them feel better and have a better life in the midst of a horrible disease that was thought to be uniformly fatal in a very short period of time when I started? Now it's completely different. People live a long time with heart failure and could even recover. I mean, who would ever believe that? And so it's fantastic to have seen the last 40 years evolve.
Well, thank you so much again for your time. This has really been a pleasure. It's inspiring. Yeah. You know, you and I have had a lot of conversations over the years, and I'm even more inspired from this one. So,
well, thank you. And you know, frankly, it would be wrong of me not to mention, Alex, that you have taught me a lot of things. I mean, bringing a mindset of the this generation of cardiologists, you have so much opportunity and so many things at your fingertips that can make your career become a spectacular career, and you've made so many good decisions. I've learned a lot from your ability to engage social media and other things, as well as keep that balance in patient care and keeping the knowledge going forward. It's been amazing to watch you, and I wish you the very best in Tulsa, and to make the center of the Heart Failure Universe Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Yes, actually, we're working on putting Tulsa on the map, which I believe that, didn't you get one of your first grants from Tulsa?
I did. I when I joined the faculty, the Warren Foundation, I was a Warren Fellow. They funded the first 5 years that led to bridging funding for my subsequent NIH grants. And it was a fantastic opportunity.
Yep. And you're here for dinner with us in Tulsa when a benefit launched, right?
Yep.
Yeah. All right. Well, looking forward to more opportunities and more conversations with you here in Tulsa or across the globe. Obviously, looking forward to the future of the heart failure space. I mean, you said it best. There's so much excitement around the field, around the innovations, the people, the community, and I can't wait for, to be a part of it, to continue to be a part of it. Obviously, I'm a couple more years junior to you, but what you've done over the last several years has been truly eye-opening, and I think for the listeners, and hopefully they've equally been inspired just as much as I have here. So,
well, I appreciate the conversation. It's been fun. Thank you, Alex.
Awesome. Thanks. Thanks for joining us for this episode of Moving the Needle in Medicine. I hope you enjoyed my discussion with Dr. Phil Adamson and found new insights to inspire your own work in healthcare. If you enjoyed this episode, you can find more on hcplive.com, and don't hesitate to share with a colleague. I'm Alexander Heidichuk. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time as we continue moving the needle in medicine.